I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Abraham Singer, assistant professor at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago. We're discussing his 2019 book, The Form of the Firm, a normative political theory of the corporation from Oxford University Press. Singer works on business ethics and political theory, the internal governance of corporations and its relationship to social justice, and democratic theory's relationship to corporations. He has published several articles on these topics in political theory and business ethics journals. First of all, Abraham Singer, let me say to you, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Abe, I love the book. It's a great analysis of a corporation and its connection to political theory. You have great command of a wide range of literature. It's really impressive in economics, business ethics, and political theory. And it's a great contribution to what's become a really growing literature on corporations and political theory. So thanks for the book. First of all, let me ask you what the motivation was for writing the book in the first place.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the kind words. So the book grew out of my dissertation that I wrote at the University of Toronto. And initially, I used to be involved in cooperatives and was really interested in them. And so originally it was going to be a project about cooperatives and defending cooperatives as, you know, the sort of the just form of economic organization or something like that. And eventually it gave way to just sort of thinking about cooperatives as a subgroup of a larger category of corporations and of firms, generally speaking. And so I got interested in that, but then the motivation to write the book and the way, you know, the way the project unfolded was really looking at these different disciplines and seeing that everybody gets part of the story correct, but misses other parts of the story. So, you know, political theory and political philosophy has been really interested in political economy for a while in terms of just distribution of benefits, worries about exploitation, worries about equality, freedom of contract, and so on. But they generally focus on, you know, the macro level of society. And there is very little attention paid to these more meso level and firms specifically. And so it's like, oh, you know, what would a normative project about these institutions look like? And then you go and look at other disciplines which focus more on the firm. So economics, they have really well-developed theories about the firm, but are less concerned with, or, and we'll talk about later, maybe have a principled non-statement or non-principled, you know, reluctance to talk about the normativity of these institutions. And then if you look at business ethics, a lot of it isn't focused on the institutions at all, but is just focused on the individual ethics of those in charge, of leadership, of virtue, and these sorts of things. So there's less about the institutional nature of these types of organizations and these types of practices that, you know, a political theorist would be interested in. So really trying to bring all three of these things to bear, the normativity of business ethics, the interest in economics and efficiency from economics, and the normativity in the institutions from political theory, and trying to put them all together to see if we can say something about corporations and firms.
Yeah, that's great. So maybe let me ask you to just as briefly as you can to sort of lay out the main argument of the book. The book is dense and complex and interesting, so it might be difficult to do this. But I, as I understood it, there's a negative and a positive argument in the book. The negative part is a critique of the Chicago School understanding. This is Chicago School for Economics understanding of the corporation, and then your positive alternative account of the corporation, which you call the relational theory of the corporation. So maybe you could just sort of sketch in broad strokes the argument.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the idea is that that corporations ought to be structured in light of certain values of justice, and I mainly am thinking of values of justice that are inherent to sort of the liberal democratic project. So certain notions of freedom, equality, and democratic decision making. And in to put it really simply, the idea is just that we don't check these values at the door when we're talking about corporations. Like, these values still have something to say, and they ought to be taken seriously when we're talking about structures of corporations, when we're talking about corporate governance, when we're talking about corporate law, when we're talking about corporate decision making. The idea that we can just bracket these values as non-applicable to this domain of social life, I want to argue against. But I also don't think it's a simple matter of just applying these things, right? So the idea is to kind of, so now we're getting less simplistic. But the idea is to say, look, corporations are specific sorts of institutions. And the way the values of justice, the way these liberal democratic commitments are going to apply to the internal processes and the internal structures of corporations is going to be complicated. And it's going to have to take seriously the type of thing that corporations are. And so, yeah, in some ways, and that sort of feeds into, I think, the way you aptly put it, that these two theses of the book. So the first is to take the economic account of the firm and the corporation as developed most seriously by the Chicago School of Economics. And you know, even though I'm arguing against it, part of the big argument of the book is we need to take it very seriously because there's lots of subtle insights about economic activity and about these institutions that we get from this literature and from this tradition. But the idea is that their route leads to precisely the sort of bracketing of these values from the internal life of corporations. And I want to argue that they're mistaken in this. And then, yes, the idea is once we do away with this view, this overly economic or economistic way of looking at corporate governance and relationships within the firm, then we can entertain the idea of what justice demands. And in that, I argue for this idea of a relational form of the corporation and seeing efficiency as being guided by and facilitated through norms, which then invites normative reflection.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, maybe to start out, it'd be helpful to sort of clarify the normative approach you take, because maybe to start out, like, if I were to engage in this project, which I'm certainly never capable, I'm certainly not capable of doing, you know, I'm an Aristotelian and a sort of Hegelian at heart. So I guess I would start and think about the question about what is this association, what's its purpose, what's its telos, and then to sort of develop out certain kinds of normative claims that result from understanding what its telos is. That I think that would be one way to sort of motivate the normative project. Another way would be, I take it to start with, you know, do the ethics first approach, to start with a certain view of justice in a liberal democratic society, and then to, this is a sort of Rawlsian approach, and then to sort of say all institutions within a liberal democracy ought to live up to these sorts of standards. So when you you know, methodologically, do you, you know, is it just a sort of version of both or one or the other, and why?
Yeah, so it's somewhere in between those two, I think. That is to say, so there is this macro level view of what justice is and, you know, sort of the just institutional arrangement. But a big thing that I want to argue is you can have that picture and then recognize that the institutional makeup of that society is going to be variegated. And so you're going to have different institutions doing different things in different ways for different purposes within that society. And so the idea is, okay, so let's say we're all good Rawlsians and, you know, the two principles of justice, great. That doesn't actually say a whole lot about what should happen within a corporation, because a corporation isn't part of the basic structure of society, which is famously what Rawls says the principles of justice apply to. I have this article from a few years back in Business Ethics Quarterly that's just called There's No Rawlsian Theory of Corporate Governance. And the idea is really, you know, you can't just take the principles of justice and just apply them internally to the corporation, because you have to take serious that the corporation is distinct from these other institutions. So there is a sort of broad principles of justice, you know, there's a kind of Rawlsianism in the background. But the idea is that once we recognize institutional pluralism and institutional variety, we have to recognize that the project of thinking normatively about these meso-level institutions is actually just going to be a lot more complicated. We're not just going to be able to take the Rawlsian bleach and apply it to the corporate stain, right? We need to actually look at the corporation, which pushes more towards the Aristotelian, the Hegelian approach that you were talking about, which is what is the what is the purpose of this thing? And I guess there's something like that there, though. I think of it in terms of maybe in terms of an institutional division of labor within this broader vision of society. So it's less like what is the inherent organic telos of the corporation, but more like within this, we have a society that has these social practices and these institutions. What type of thing is the corporation? What type of thing is the market? How can we reconstruct the normative bases of these things? And based on that, try to articulate some normative principles or some prescriptive guidance going forward.
Yeah. I mean, I take it, I guess I would, I mean, one question would be sort of, you know, is this a view that it's justice, that justice on the Rawlsian view isn't sort of univocal across different associations, but it takes different forms in different associations? That could be one view. Or I take it, and this is more of the spirit of this sort of Aristotelian view, that different associations within society serve different kinds of functions and provide different kinds of goods. And so justice is just one good, and that's the good of the association we call political life. But, you know, our economic associations serve different kinds of goods. And so part of the task of a political theory of a corporation would be to think about how to balance those different goods, right? That are in some way incommensurable, in some way sort of in trade-off with one another. I mean, is that how you think about it? Or you think about it as sort of the justice is the Rawlsian first virtue of all public institutions?
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit closer to the Rawlsian. You know, I try to...
Yeah.
I always say I'm not a Rawlsian because it's a Rawlsian that I'm not, right? That's the thing that I'm always pushing back against, which means that I'm probably closer to that. I'm playing in his sandbox, even if I don't agree with him entirely. So, I'm open to the idea that it's justice isn't the only value that we need to concern ourselves with social in social institutions. But I guess a big part of the argument of the book is that it is a value that matters when we're talking about corporations. That is, even if we could say, oh, there's some institutions where justice isn't the key virtue we need to consider ourselves, you know, we can have that argument. But I want to say with corporations, precisely because of the type of institution they are and the way they fit into social cooperation and certain levers of compulsion, justice does matter for them, just in a way distinct from the way we think it applies to statutory institutions.
Yeah, I see. I mean, the reason I ask this is in part, I mean, I was just sort of wondering of the overall shape of the normative approach. I mean, it, in part, it matters because a little bit later in the book, you talk about different sort of different views in political theory that have sort of tried to bring normativity into the corporation. And one of them is a kind of eudaimonist approach that says something like, well, the reason that we should introduce norms into the corporation is because if we don't, and we're just interested in a purely efficiency-based maximizing profit type view, that makes people really unhappy. I mean, that sort of view about the good life, which I take it again, has that sort of Aristotelian heritage, is somewhat different than the just justice-based approach. It's sort of what do corporations owe to its members, which we can kind of generate out of either the function or the overall normative structure of the state.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so again, yeah, it's a bit more leaning towards justice, though I'm, as I make clear in the book, I'm not entirely unfriendly to certain flavors of eudaimonism, or I find them interesting. It's actually funny, we're talking about this. It originally in the dissertation, I had this, in the conclusion, I had this thing where I start, I sort of go like, underneath all of this, there's a Hegelian view of society where the corporation fits within. And one of my just dissertation supervisors, Joe Karens, is like, you can keep this in here, but just note that nobody will like it. he was like, people who hate Hegel will hate this, and people who like Hegel will hate this. Like, there's just no way this is gonna. So, you know, keep it in if you really care about. And so, you know, all that to say is there, but there is something, you know, part of the approach is trying to articulate the values imminent to the institutions that we find ourselves enmeshed in. You know, and trying to articulate them and see how they contradict with practices that we engage in. And, you know, there's a degree to which that has a, you know, a Hegelian genome in it.
Yeah, no, I take it.
I'm not against that, right?
But yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, an important Hegelian moment in your, and first of all, I should say, you know, Joe is very sensible in his advice there. So thanks, Joe. You know, but hey, eventually everybody comes around to Hegel anyway, right. Are you?
I always say I think I'm a Hegelian, except I don't really understand Hegel. I'm sure if I did, I'd be a Hegelian, but I'm never sure. It's like nailing Jell-O to the wall.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. He, you know, the moment I took you to be most Hegelian is when you talk about how we need to maintain efficiency as a sort of core feature of the corporation, that, you know, that's a sort of limiting good or limiting feature, or limiting principle for the kinds of claims about justice that we need to make. There's certain, you know, because we can't like have justice swamp this sort of core feature of the institution. So that's a kind of case in which you're, like Hegel does, sort of analyzing the underlying rationality of the development of this institution and saying, why do we have this at all in the first place? Well, it's the kind of thing that can bring wealth, that has brought wealth in immense amounts to Western societies.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, and then, so part of it, and I'm glad you see it that way, because that is underlying that. And then the other part, of course, is, and we can talk more about this, is that disregarding the economic function or the efficiency imperative of corporations will also undermine a normative project as well, right? That is, if you're trying to apply thick moral notions to the corporation without any regard towards its efficiency, the thing won't work very well, and then the moral project will be for naught. So I think the sort of that Hegelian aspect and the more functional prudential aspect kind of marry pretty well in this instance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, let me ask you, just as we're still on the sort of broad strokes in the introduction and the argument, one of the ways you frame the book is in light of, I mean, there is some political theory that's sort of, and political philosophy that's sort of tried to tackle these similar issues. And I'm thinking of, well, I wanted to ask you about Elizabeth Anderson, but David Seepley, and well, I had on the podcast Lisa Herzog, who I think you know. You talked about her in the preface, yeah?
Yeah. She's been very, very helpful for me in this project.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Anderson, you sort of pose the matter of the corporation, so puzzle about the corporation in a similar way that she does, which is in her work, at least as far as if I remember it correctly, part of the idea is that corporations are kind of strange in the sense that they're part of markets, and so which markets purport to be free and individuals can sign up or leave at any moment. But at the same time, once you're in a corporation, they're actually authoritarian regimes in the sense that you're sort of subject to this hierarchy, this boss who has in many cases arbitrary power over you, and sort of trying to figure out that puzzle is in large part the purpose of her book. Although you kind of take that puzzle in a sort of different sort of way. Maybe you could say a little bit about how your work stands towards hers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of that was also, I had completed the manuscript and completed the dissertation, and then she gave those lectures and I was like, well,
I see.
Scooped by Anderson.
Right.
but I think it's a really, I really enjoy reading that book. But I think, you know, where I would say and in many ways we're approaching it in a quite similar manner, but I think she underestimates again the importance of the economics of the firm, and not just, you know, because it is an economic institution, but the importance for understanding the economics of the firm in order to articulate the political theory of the firm, right? That is, if you I think in many ways she's right about the moral concerns, and I try to articulate those though in slightly different ways. But the point is that if you're not taking seriously the efficiency basis for why the hierarchy of the firm exists in the first place, like why you have hierarchy in the marketplace, you're not going to be able to articulate a very strong theory about to what to do with regards to that hierarchy, how to hold it accountable, how to make it more democratic, or whatever sort of moral vision you have for it. So in many ways, the pushback against Anderson would be really that point, just sort of efficiency matters a bit more than she lets on. That would maybe be a good way.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I got from Anderson's book that I guess I didn't see as prominently in yours was she's concerned with exploitation as a sort of core injustice of the contemporary corporation. Do you see exploit? I mean, is that part of the story? I'm certainly willing to say I missed it in the book, but is that a core part of the story in your view, or is that folded under the justice failures of corporations?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess, I mean, exploitation can be used in a lot of different ways. And I largely refrain from using exploitation just because I don't want it to be mistaken for the Marxist notion of exploitation. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in the sense of unjust hierarchical power, unjust authority that takes advantage of those who are subject to it, mm-hmm. I might not call it exploitation, but that is certainly a key concern of why we want to articulate a political theory of the corporation in the first place, right? So, mm-hmm. So in that regard, I don't use that word for a variety of reasons, but I certainly am concerned with exploitation, yes.
Why don't you think there's much political theory that has been done on the corporation? Do you have a read on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess there's maybe a few reasons. One would be the influence of Rawls on political philosophy. So that really directed a lot of analytic political philosophy towards, the principles of justice for society, right? Again, this macro level picture. And to be clear, that's not a knock against these things. It's just if once you're articulating the project at that level, it's, the corporation's going to look like a derivative project, right? As opposed to something to focus on in and of itself. So I think that would be one. I think the other is for a while, and I could be mistaken about this, but I think a lot of political theorists have been very phobic of economics. Mm-hmm. Either for methodological reasons or political reasons, sort of seeing it as inherently flawed and corrupt in its own right. And so there's been, except for deeply critical engagement, there's been, I think, some reluctance of political theorists, especially of a critical bent, which I associate with, to look to economics as a resource for learning about things, as opposed to just, where you go and uncover the ideology of your political foes. So I think those two reasons might be part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, insofar as political theorists do to talk about these things, there tends to be still a kind of Marxist inflected approach to it. I mean, even in somebody like Habermas, who I think you talked briefly about, but the core distinction between system and life world, right? Is a sort of life world is all the good Gemeinschaft, these type stuff, and the system is all, the economics. And there's much less attention to the development of the corporation and theories of the corporation after Marx, which you take up quite well in the book.
Right. Yeah. And in some ways, that's really, there's different ways of articulating what I'm trying to do here. One is just to say, I think a lot of political theorists kind of take the Marxist theory of exploitation as the theory of employment and the theory of the firm. And just sort of saying, well, there's been a good bit of economic literature and economic debate. I think that's the other part, is political theorists sort of think of economics as this, monolith, and instead of recognizing that there's huge debates and divergences within it, which can be resourceful for normative theory.
Good. Yeah. So let's talk about the first part of the book, which is the negative part of the book, although a fair bit of it is quite interesting, sort of history that we were just referring to, the history of the corporate or theories of the corporation, how it's been conceived and defended or critiqued by classical theories and then more contemporary theories. The first chapter or so is about the classical theories. So ones that are very familiar to us: Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx, and they have certain insights about the corporation, although they kind of get eclipsed by later developments in your view. Do you think, I guess what, I mean, you don't have to go through like the story there, readers can, I think, go to it, but do you think anything is sort of still living in their insights about the corporation, or are they sort of wholly superseded by later economic developments?
Oh, no. I think there's still plenty to get. Yeah, and in part, the some of what I want to get at in that first chapter is to get at the point that of those three, Marx really understands the firm the best. That is, Adam Smith is, yeah, he has the pin factory, and he talks about the invisible, and he kind of doesn't quite capture how distinct the what's going on within the pin factory is from the invisible hand of the marketplace. Whereas Marx, that's in many ways the centerpiece of his political economy, right? Is that what happens within the enterprise, what's happening within the factory, is power. It's where this is all laid bare and laid naked, right? And so in many ways, you know, I think Marx kind of captured a lot of what the big problem is, what the big puzzle is, which is that in a liberal market society, you're committed to certain values. The way he puts it is freedom, equality, contract, and Bentham, or something. I'm missing one of those things. But he goes, you know, it's the Eden of these rights, and yet within the factory, none of those things exist, right? Mm-hmm. And for him, that's part of the contradiction of capital. And that I'm not as committed to. But I think his point that there is this big divergence and there's this big tension between the internal dynamics of the firm and the principles that structure the market, I think was spot on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe you could take us through the sort of story that's less familiar to us. Is that the sort of responses to the classical theorists and especially to Marx, yeah, by theorists like Ronald Coase, you talk about quite a bit, and then the Chicago school. Maybe you could just sketch the sort of broad strokes of how they conceived of the corporation in a way that sort of responded to some of these worries by Marx.
Sure. And I should be clear that that's my way of phrasing it, is that Marx introduces the problem, and then they're also, Coase isn't really referring to Marx in his writings exactly. But, you know, if you look at it historically, I really feel like Marx articulates the problem and then Coase is kind of dealing with it later. But so Coase, in this famous 1937 article, The Nature of the Firm, really articulates this problem. But he's not a Marxist, so it has less of the critical flair to it. But to him, it's just this puzzle, which is, why is it that we have, you know, amidst this free market, why do we have all of these little hierarchies? Why do we have all of these bureaucracies? Why do we have authority within the market? I mean, the way, you know, he has this really, you know, the lumps of butter coagulated in pails of buttermilk is his very, very, very weird metaphor for describing it. Or it's not even his. I think it's Robinson's. Anyway, but the idea, right, is that if free markets do all this stuff so well, if they're so efficient, if the invisible hand of Adam Smith works so well, how come markets are dominated by firms where internally we see precisely the opposite, right? We don't see competition, we don't see free exchange, we see planning. And so again, that's like a rearticulation of the Marxist point in neoclassical language or through a neoclassical framework. And his answer, famously, was that the reason why you have firms, the reason why you have hierarchy within the market, is because hierarchy can often be more efficient than the invisible hand of the market, than just, you know, free exchange and competition. And his explanation for this was transaction costs. The key idea being that what formal theories of the market often miss, and he was talking a while ago, but even now people kind of can skate past this if they don't think closely with it, is that using the market, engaging in market transactions, always entails costs, right? It's never frictionless. And so the ideas that he gives are, you know, the cost of discovering the right price for things. But you can also think of the cost of writing up contracts, right? The cost of actually thinking through what the contract should be when you're engaging in a transaction. That this is going to be really costly.
And so, or bargaining, I suppose.
Yeah, right? Any of these processes we associate with the market. And the idea is like, yeah, it's in those instances, it's way more efficient to just say, you know, you, Steve, you're in charge. Tell people what to do. And that's actually, you know, so there's actually efficiency gains to be had by superseding the market, superseding the price mechanism of the market. And that's where he gives this analytic distinction between what a firm is and what a market transaction is, and that market transactions are mediated by prices. So you and I cooperate, not consciously, but because you offer a price for some good and then I buy it and now we're cooperating, but because the price was right. In contrast to the market, firms, cooperation in the firm isn't mediated by prices, it's mediated by command or by the dictate of the entrepreneur or the manager. So I take two things to be really important about this. One is just the clear articulation of the distinction between firms and markets. And the other is the idea that the firm exists because of its comparative advantage in terms of efficiency.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I don't know Coase at all, so this strikes me as something of a strange claim, because it relies on some kind of account of the wisdom of the hierarchy, right? Because, I mean, in some sense, you might say, yeah, you know, sure, it's it would be inefficient to have a market all the way down. It'd be better to have people in charge and sort of make the right decisions, but that relies on having people who can make the right decisions, who aren't thoroughly incompetent or thoroughly corrupt. So, I mean, does he have an account of
why we
should expect that kind of, you know, that sort of competent and non-corrupt people in charge?
Yeah, I mean, so here, even though he said that there's like a socialist flavor to this period of his thought, because he's sort of arguing for the comparative advantage of planning and hierarchy over markets, it's important to recognize he's not, you know, he's still a market guy. And so the idea is that there still would be an optimum amount of planning because the firm is still subject to market competition. So, of course, you know, it's not a sanguine view saying like, oh, any hierarchy is better. Any hierarchy is okay. The idea is that the reason why these institutions survive is because they're more efficient than doing it through private contracting. The reason why you have hierarchical relationships. But of course, the corporation or the firm can get too big. Too much can be planned by the manager, or, you know, he calls it the entrepreneur. Too much can be done by this person. And then that's going to be costly. And then eventually they're going to start to suffer in the marketplace and they'll start to downsize, right? Or the person in charge will be overly corrupt and there'd be reasons to think that you'd want to remove this person. And in many ways, the criticism in the way of saying, look, this is why more than market mechanisms are needed, is because sometimes the market is inefficient or ineffective at removing bad CEOs. And so you need other mechanisms to come in. But the key Coasean insight, I think, is still pretty plausible, which is that hierarchy exists and would continue to exist because of its efficiency advantages. Insofar as, you know, the rest of the market is working well, it will tend to have a check or tend to push back on firms that aren't performing well, or, you know, people who are in charge who aren't planning well.
I don't know if that quite
clarifies things.
No, I think that's right. I mean, if I have this right, it's sort of market competition gives each firm an incentive to hire and put in place people in charge who are who will most maximize profits and who will be competent and non-corrupt.
Exactly.
Right? If they start to lose in competition, then you're going to either get rid of those people or the firm is going to go. Is going to go bankrupt. But yeah, on the scale point, the size point, I mean, it's interesting in a way, because you'd think that part of the theory would point towards the bigger, the better, right? Because if you have a bunch of small businesses kicking around, that's very inefficient,
right?
Benjamin family businesses, is extremely inefficient. Huge businesses like Walmart are are much more efficient. But so then that raises the question, well, what's the point at which it sort of flip? What's the tipping point where it starts to flip into, you know, corruption? And is it sort of the emergence of a kind of monopoly or monopsony that you start to see the worries develop? Or
I guess there would be two things. So strictly speaking, Coase, in that article, he talks about bureaucratic costs. So the idea is that planning isn't costless either, right? So it's not like hierarchy and planning are these panaceas that cure the ills of the costs associated with market transactions. The idea is that these comparatively can be better, but they entail costs. And once it gets too big, you can have bureaucratic bloating, right? So it wouldn't just be that planning all the way up will just be the cure-all and always more efficient, right? So again, it's a more dynamic understanding of these things. But the way later thinkers tried to capture this, there would be two different ways that you'd worry about this. One would be in terms of market power. So a firm gets so big that they start to command monopoly or monopsony and they can dictate prices. And there, that would be the inefficiency of, you know, the firm getting so big that it challenges the inefficiency of the market, right? The firm becomes so big that it, you know, it uses the invisible hand and scratches its back with it or something like that. right. So that would be one concern. And that's loosely associated with the Harvard School of Industrial Organization that you get in the mid-20th century. Of these worries about monopoly because it gives these big firms power in the marketplace that is harmful. But then the other concern is something that was articulated famously by Burley and Means, and that this sort of gets to the idea that you were talking about before, which is that the people in charge can become so entrenched that they're actually resistant to change and they cease to pursue the ends that the corporation ought to be pursuing and instead pursue their own ends through the vehicle of the corporation. That is, they wield power within the corporation in such a way that it becomes inefficient and unjust. So those two concerns kind of grow out of the basic insight that hierarchy and authority can be efficient. So one is sort of outward looking, that then that authority becomes detrimental to market efficiency, and the other is inward looking, and that power and authority can be detrimental to the inner workings of the corporation.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of sounds like, in a way, a kind of return of Marx, because this is sort of Marxian insight. If capitalism works more efficiently by growing the size of corporations and bigger corporations swallowing up littler corporations, that actually is beneficial to the efficiency gains in capitalism. Mm-hmm. Well, eventually that's going to end up in its self-destructive cycle, because as it said, it's going to get big. These theorists, I guess, say it's going to get big enough so that it's going to be it's going to result in less efficiency when you develop some kind of monopoly or corruption and so forth.
And you also had people like Galbraith in the middle of the 20th century sort of saying what was going to eventually happen is you'd have this convergence between socialism and capitalism, where socialism would develop some more market mechanisms. But then these capitalist markets would develop these big corporations that would eventually kind of become a socialist planned economy, so that you'd start to see more convergence between these two economies, these two systems in various ways.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. So anyway, I mean, it strikes me that this is a helpful point, because it seems to me from your book that this is the point where the Chicago School and your account diverge, which is, you know, the Chicago School aims to develop something of an account of the firm that maybe you could understand as responding to these sorts of problems, whereas you want to bring norms in to sort of restrict or maintain the integrity of the firm. So maybe you say a little bit about the Chicago School. You know, what is the Chicago School and what's their view of the firm?
Yeah, and this is also a place where I think mine and Elizabeth Anderson view are distinct, is that I see Coase as having an uncomfortable relationship with the Chicago School intellectually. I don't know socially, but just that because he has a number of different lineages and a number of different legacies. And so there's this point about his notion that authority and hierarchy have this comparative advantage over the market in certain instances, under certain constraints, right? And to me, I think that's a key insight and introduces this question of, okay, then normatively, what ought we to do about the power that this creates, whether we're talking about it externally or internally? And so that, in many ways, that's the question I'm trying to answer, right? How should we think about the power that the authority of and hierarchy of the firm creates? What the Chicago School of Law and Economics does, and this is in part growing out of another key article of Ronald Coase's, his article, The Problem of Social Cost, from 1960, which is a very, very influential piece, but also, you know, Gary Becker, Stigler, all of these guys, is they try to say, oh, we actually don't need to worry about the power within the firm. And the way they do that is by saying, well, what is the firm? It's this thing that kind of looks like hierarchy, but when you look at it really, it's actually closer to what Altian and Demschitz refer to as a privately owned market. That is, what's really going on within the firm is people are responding to price signals, essentially. They don't look exactly like price signals, but they're more or less, you know, people responding to incentives. And so they have this idea that, like, look, what looks like power, what looks like authority, what looks like somebody having the ability to command you is really just them offering you options and you responding the way you will. And so they kind of want to say, you know, the way I put it is that they take the Coasean firm and they turn it back into a market. And once you do that, the question of what should we do about this illegitimate power disappears, because there isn't really power in any normatively worrying sense, and therefore it can't be exercised illegitimately. And so then it's just kind of a market. You should kind of let stuff happen within the corporation, happen within the firm. You know, it has to be within the law, but the law should be minimal, and we shouldn't be trying to govern the types of relationships, the type of governance structures, the type of hierarchy that we find within the firm, because at the end of the day, it's kind of just the result of people's free choices anyway, and is more or less efficient.
Right. So that's, everybody's making a cost benefit analysis in a corporation. And if worker, you know, management tries to push its power as far as possible, workers respond by doing a cost benefit. And, you know, if the costs outweigh the benefits and then they quit, then management might respond. Right. So, okay. So good.
Yeah. So the famous scene from Mad Men in the book at this point, where there's that famous scene where Don Draper and Peggy Olson are arguing. And he says, you know, that's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas. And she says, but you never say thank you. And his response is, well, that's what the money is for. and it's this amazing scene. But in a lot of ways, that's what the Chicago School's argument sort of is, right? Is, you know, you don't need the vote. You don't need all of these things. That's what the money is for. The money induces you to do it.
Right. The soulless capitalist view is the Chicago School. Okay. Yeah. So what's your beef with them? What's the problem with this view?
So, well, first let me say what I think is good about it, because I think that's important, which is, and because part of my argument is that those of us who wish to criticize corporations and firms need to take this economic view seriously. And, you know, again, their big point is efficiency is really important when you're talking about these things, both normatively, because efficiency is a really important value in society, but also prudentially, because ultimately, if you're trying to structure these things and it makes them radically inefficient, they won't be effective in achieving whatever normative aims you're trying to achieve. So I think that's really important, and I want to highlight that. But ultimately, I think the big problem is it's just they rely too much on this form of instrumental and strategic rationality that undercuts what the actual experience and what the actual relationships are within a firm or within a corporation. You know, so the idea that when your boss tells you to do something, you treat it like a price, that's just, yeah, I always say, like, they clearly never worked for anybody, right? Like, because that's just not the experience. That's not what it feels like in the moment, because you're not actually just responding and doing a cost benefit analysis and responding to price signals. What you're actually doing is responding to authority. And the key idea here that I try to bring out, and this is the second section of the book where I really try to criticize what I take to be the flaw in the Chicago, one of the major flaws of the Chicago school, is to say that we're motivated in a number of different ways. One is by external incentives, and that's where the price mechanism works best. But we're also motivated by intrinsic incentives, the incentive to follow scripts, the incentive to, you know, fit in, all of these sort of more, these social types of incentives. And that these often, A, are really effective at getting people to do stuff, and B, are really the type of things that you see within firms, right? So when your boss tells you to do something, I mean, at some point it'll push you to the brink and you might say, you know, this job isn't worth it, I quit. But often before you get there, what's actually going on is, oh, this person in authority who occupies the corner office, who's wearing a specific sort of suit or whatever, they're telling me to do something. The role is they do tell me to do something and I figure out how to respond based on the fact that it's an authority figure telling us what to do. That is, what the firm does is taps into these social scripts that motivate us and get us to do things in various ways. And once you take that part seriously, thinking that people are just responding to prices with voluntary choices really deflates and minimizes a lot of the dynamics and a lot of the power that actually obtains within the firm, and which makes firms efficient. Right? I mean, that's sort of the crucial part, right? Is part of the way that part of the reason why we have firms and why they're able to have comparative advantages over markets is precisely because they use these incentives that aren't really available on the market. They use these intrinsic notions of these ideas of belonging in a group and teamwork and, you know, authority, all of these things. They use them in order to get people to do things that would be harder to do on an open market where cooperation is merely mitigated by price.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So, I mean, this is helpful. One of the things I was wondering is whether your critique is a sort of descriptive or prescriptive or normative critique of the Chicago school. And it sounds like it's a descriptive critique. That is, that the Chicago school doesn't. At the bottom, the question for the Chicago school, from your view, is they can't really explain the emergence of corporations at all, as opposed to, I mean, Zero, on their view, if everything's a market, why have a corporation at all?
Precisely.
Why not just have a bunch of individuals who have exchanges? I mean, so in a way, misses the Coasean insight, about transaction. So does Chicago School address the transaction cost issue or no?
I mean, a lot of them do, and you know, again, this is an admitted part of the book, is I also treat the Chicago school as one monolith, and there's, of course, disagreements within it, right? So here I'm just talking about the most influential text for understanding the firm and understanding the corporation and understanding corporate law. And, you know, it gets kind of vague because they go back and forth between the efficiency advantages of the firm, and there they treat it like a market. And then other times when they do recognize that it's authority, they sort of fall back to a kind of libertarian position. You know, they sort of oscillate between a welfarist view that we should allow this authority to happen because it's efficient, and a libertarian view of we should allow this authority because people have freely chosen it. So, you know, they're smart people, right? So they do try to deal with it, but ultimately I think they have trouble grappling with this problem. Because in order to do so, you'd really need to give up a key part of the Chicago School project, which is this idea that people are responding to prices and that you can really understand a lot of social interactions through this economic lens. And part of what I want to say is this key economic institution is using, you really need a social and political lens to understand why it has these economic advantages.
Yeah, one of the other things I was thinking about in this context was, you know, in a way, it seems like there's a normative argument against them too, in the sense that, I mean, I can imagine, and your Mad Men example brings this out, that you can imagine firms that are actually set up along Chicago school lines, which are, you know, it's just simply that everyone really is part of a corporation and are purely in a transactional or instrumental relationship with one another. Maybe we've all been in jobs where we experience that, where there's no sense of loyalty, or, you know, it's all instrumental.
No, I think
and that's bad too. I mean, that's bad from a normative perspective, right?
Exactly, right. I mean, part of it is a descriptive claim, but it feeds into my overall concern, which is this normative vision of just reducing human sociality to market transactions, which I think is both flawed empirically and bad normatively.
Right.
I mean, you know, we can talk about this maybe a little bit later, because I don't get into it as much in the book. But in a lot of ways, you can understand a lot of gig economy businesses as trying to do precisely this, right?
Yeah.
Just reduce everything literally to prices and say, no, we're just offering our drivers a price, right? That's what's going on here.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's maybe we'll come back to that. That's great. Yeah. So let's talk about the second part of the book, the your positive account of relational account of the corporation. So, I mean, you set it up but basically in the way that we've been talking about, that corporations are not simply markets. They're markets plus agents respond not just to market incentives, but also to normative claims. Normative norms sort of pervade every corporate structure.
Yep.
And so the question then becomes sort of what norms should corporations have? I think maybe at this point you talk about different arguments for where to bring normative concerns in, mm-hmm. that you are sort of critical of, especially folks who talk about workplace democracy, or, you know, expanding democratizing all institutions in society. Maybe you can say a little bit about what you take to be the sort of overreaching of these, you know, these normative approaches.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, what I try and grasp from my engagement with the economic theory of the firm from the 20th century is essentially to say, look, the Chicago School overstates their claim, and they overplay their hand. And if you try to reduce everything, trying to turn the firm back into a market makes it hard to understand what's going on in the firm, and it misses all of these crucial normative problems that authority and hierarchy raise, right? So you can't explain a whole lot. So you need to take hierarchy, authority, power seriously and not try to minimize or deflate them. However, what I take to be correct about the economic theory of the firm is that, again, these are institutions that exist in part because they are more efficient than markets. And what that means is that if they become so bloated, if they cease to be efficient, then they will, you know, start to disband, you'll have fewer of them, they'll become smaller, and you'll be able to ask less of them. And so what I argue is that efficiency is what I call a constitutional value of the corporation or of the firm. So we can and we should, and I think we must, demand more of the internal dynamics of a firm from a normative perspective than we currently do. But we don't, that's not a trump card, if we can still use that term. But like, you can't just say like, aha, yeah, there's power. Power is worrisome from a normative perspective. Therefore, we must democratize the firm. Because you have to take seriously the efficiency of the firm. And I think a lot of workplace Democrats, to whom I'm largely sympathetic in any ways, but I think they don't pay enough attention to efficiency and the way in which a firm can be still capable of competing in a marketplace. And I think taking that seriously doesn't get rid of the case for workplace democracy. It just makes it slightly more complicated and a little more, you have to look at it with less rose-colored glasses.
Yeah. So maybe you can say a little bit about how democratizing the workplace would come at the cost of efficiency. I mean, because I take it some diehard Democrats will say, That's not going to be a trade-off. We can have efficiency or even more efficiency because democracy, there's a wisdom in the crowds or whatever. And authoritarian rule is actually inefficient because it leads to what I said earlier, which is sort of incompetent or corrupt rulers. Whereas democracy in the workplace is actually going to bring more goodies along with more justice.
Yeah.
So why do you think there's a trade-off?
Well, so I should say that. So in some ways, I'm open to that empirical argument. And I actually, again, I think the conclusion is complicated there. And I'll talk about that in a second. But I think the first part is just recognizing that the trade-off matters. Whether or not it exists, mm-hmm. even asking, is there a trade-off matters. And a lot of, you know, so if you go and look at Robert Dahl's writings on this stuff, he just says, you know, if we demand democracy in the state, we must demand it in the firm or in the enterprise. So a lot of people have this very deontological intuitions where it's like, oh, there is authority, therefore we must democratize the authority. And so just the first part is just recognizing that, well, but the firm is also doing these other things that matter. And if democratizing authority, and that's an if, but if doing that compromises those other things, it's a mark against democratization, right? So the first part is just articulating that claim that a lot of political theorists don't articulate, right? The conditional in the first place. Now, the second part is empirically, does democratization tend to make things more or less efficient? And, you know, based on my reading of the literature, it's mixed. It depends on the industry. It depends on the firm. It depends on a whole lot of stuff. So a lot of people will say democratization, you know, so I guess to make things more complicated, and this might get a little too scattershot, so you can feel free to rein me in if you feel like I'm going. So there is this question. So even if we say, okay, we should democratize the firm, there's a question of on whose behalf ought we democratize it. So there's this idea that workers should be the people in charge, but you might also think that customers should be in charge. And in the 19th century, this was a huge debate between advocates of cooperatives. Some people thought, you know, you needed to have worker cooperatives, and other people thought you needed to have customer cooperatives. And, you know, and that these two things don't fit comfortably with one another should just show you how difficult of a terrain this is. But let's say we settle, right, that it's workers who deserve the franchise within the firm. Some people say there's efficiency advantages to this in a variety of ways. One is which if workers control the firm, you need to expend less resources on behalf of the firm monitoring workers, right? Because workers can monitor themselves. So the idea is a huge amount of costs that capital-owned firms need to outlay is overseeing the workers. But if the workers are in charge, you don't need to do that as much. I think that misses some things about collective action problems and the fact that people can collectively think one thing and then individually still defect. I think it's right to say that worker cooperatives need to outlay less in terms of monitoring costs. But there's other costs that can also entail, and one that Henry Hansman famously argued for was that there's costs associated with decision-making. The idea being that one of the advantages that capital has in owning firms is that they all roughly have similar goals. And so it's actually pretty easy to make decisions. That is, everybody, you know, you don't need to argue that much. You might argue about long-term and short-term strategies, but overall, you know, you're trying to create profit. You're trying to create value. What Hansman argued is that when you have a very, very variegated workforce with different people of different backgrounds doing different jobs and relating to the firm in radically different ways, they'll actually have very different ideas about what should happen in the boardroom, and that this will actually make decision-making more costly. That's fair enough as far as it goes. I actually think that if you're having better decisions get made, it's maybe worth doing that. But part of his argument is that it might also result in worse decisions or no decisions. You don't make decisions in a timely manner, and so opportunities are missed. So that was one big cost that he argued for. Another big problem that workplace democracies face is getting capital. You know, so part of the advantage of having capital own the firm is that they have capital. With workers, they tend not to, right? Or tend not to have as much, and certainly not as much at, you know, just to dispose on a risky investment to start an enterprise. And furthermore, because they don't have the same type of assets, they're less likely to get loans. So it's actually very difficult for, you know, and this is a crucial problem that workplace democracy and worker-owned firms have, which is gaining the capital to start their enterprise. So those are costs.
That's really interesting. I mean, some of this sort of connects up with debates in deliberative democracy about whether more deliberation is better or not, yeah. Right? I mean, one view is, yes, more deliberation is better because you have the wisdom of the crowds, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Another view is, you know, in the more skeptical democracy view, this is more deliberation actually creates more conflict and sort of creates more instability and so forth. So I can certainly see that as an issue in democratizing the workplace. What about the other thing I was thinking about was sort of short-term versus long-term governance. And I mean, on the one hand, I could see arguments on either side that capital could be short-term in its thinking, whereas workers could be more long-term since they have more skin in the game, whereas capital, there's a limited liability. So they may look for more goodies more quickly. So it might be more efficient in the long run to have a more democratized approach. You have any read on that as far as maybe which comes out ahead on that particular issue?
Well, so cooperatives have limited liability as well. Most cooperatives are legally recognized as cooperative corporations. And so, you know, their owners have limited liability in various ways as well. So it's interesting. There is this famous article about this written by this economist, Benjamin Ward. It's called The Firm in Illyria. And he's writing about Yugoslavian work councils. And it's a formal model of these things. But basically, he argues that an economy dominated by workplace-owned firms is just going to tend to be less efficient. And the idea is that, let me see if I can get the logic of this correct. It's been a while. But the idea is that worker-owned firms will tend to respond perversely to price signals because the owners are also factors of production. So the idea is that when the price is high, what you should be doing is hiring more workers to make more, right, to produce more. That's the way a firm is supposed to respond to the price signal. But what he argued is that worker-owned firms will tend to stop hiring then because all of the workers will want to reap the profits. And then he argued, conversely, when the price is low and they should be hiring fewer workers, they'll actually want to hire more workers, hire more owners to get more capital in and to spread the losses. And so his argument was just fundamentally worker-owned firms are sort of not equipped to respond to price signals the correct way. I actually think he overstated that case and dramatically. And a big problem that he has, and it works also with the way people talk about capital-owned firms as well, is that it overstates just how much democracy is actually happening within any of these firms. So, you know, like on his account, it's almost like every decision is by plebiscite, by like the workers when they get together. But worker-owned firms have managers too, and they have bylaws as well, right? And they have procedures and institutions the same way corporations do. And so in some ways, the problem with both of these accounts is that they overstate the role of the actual owners in the management and decision-making of a firm. Whereas in actuality, often there's a separation between ownership and control, and there's, you know, again, institutionalized decision-making and bylaws and procedures that actually check a lot of these decisions. So the point would be, I actually think it might matter less who ultimately owns. I'll qualify that in a second. But ultimately, those institutions and bylaws and those sorts of things really matter. That being said, I think there is a case to be made that worker-owned firms will often tend to be, you know, more committed to, say, keeping businesses in the region where they are, right? You know, so that sort of community sustainability and not sacrificing that for short-term profit, you probably see more of that in worker-owned firms than you would in capital-owned firms because of the incentives involved. Although even there, you do see, you know, cooperatives sell off their shares and become capital, you know, become sort of standard business corporations because it's in the people who hold the shares' interests.
So, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, if there's too much of a trade-off with efficiency, they're gonna lose out in the Darwinian competition with the capital and firm.
Or they're worried about retirement, and you know they can sell this off to an investor and make some money, right? I think people often forget that, you know, workers who own a firm aren't just in it for the democracy.
There's
strategic components to this, and taking those seriously is important.
I mean, and what you say about the a few moments ago was good, because I think often in discussions of this, there's often a, you know, very crude view of, you know, either corporations are structured in an authoritarian way or in a radically participatory democratic way. Whereas in reality, it's often, you know, it's a sort of constitutional liberal democracy, I guess, or a constitutional authoritarian rule. That is, there's a sort of rule of law that that governs much of this. I guess the last question on this is what about something like the German model, where there is sort of mixed governance of capital and labor? I mean, how does that sort of fare versus other, like the American model?
Yeah, so I'm a bit I haven't looked at the literature in a little while on this. Part of the problem with the book is that I was way sharper on this like 4 years ago.
But we ask you all these questions, many years after you finish the book.
So the German model of co-determination gives workers and institutionalized labor and institutionalized seats at the table. And that works in various ways, but it's also important to note that there's also ways around that. So often in a lot of corporations, you end up with the board being relatively disempowered and then the shareholder committees having a lot of power, and then the board becomes more of a rubber stamp, right? Or, a lot of those boards are figured so that, yes, labor has a seat at the table, but capital has more of a seat at the table. So all is to say is I think a lot of those things are interesting to think about, but I'm normatively quite in favor of a lot of those things, but it is important to recognize that, again, they're not cure-alls, and then there's ways that people contract around these things. And so even those solutions might not actually create the types of outcomes that you're striving for.
Yeah. So how much, maybe we can move into, you talk about corporate law and corporate, we've been talking a lot about governance, but so we could talk more about corporate law and corporate ethics or business ethics. I mean, how much do you think, you have this view about minimal and maximal viability horizons. That's a technical term that you introduce. And it's basically a way to, as far as I understood it, to talk about the trade-offs that exist with efficiency gains in the accumulation of wealth versus the normative values that we would hope corporations would strive to realize. So maybe you talk a little bit about that. I mean, how much do you think that corporations ought to be expected to have trade-offs with efficiency to realize these values, and what kinds of values are we talking about?
Yeah. So the way I put it is, so again, norms are necessary for achieving the efficiency gains that firms have over markets. And so you need to have these norms. And that's what I call the minimal viability horizon. You need to have norms such that you can outperform the market. Right. But then the idea of the maximal viability horizon is that If you ask so much of firms that they become radically inefficient, they can't make decisions, they have to spend so much of their costs on various commitments that they actually, they end up in the red or whatever, that this would make you less efficient, and then people would start to privately contract and defect from the firm. And that's the maximal viability horizon. And so the idea is that there's this space for norms, that we ought to demand normatively various things of the firm, and we can do it because there's a minimal viability horizon, but we can't do it to such an extent that they become radically inefficient. The idea is that if you want to, say, democratize or make just the firm, you also have to make sure there is a firm there in the first place to democratize or make just. And that means attending to the efficiency constraints that they operate under. And so what I do is... So early on in the book, I just sort of say, look, we need some normative commitments to get this going. I'm just going to take three, what I take to be pretty uncontroversial values that are imminent to our social institutions, which are the value of liberal democracy. So again, individual freedom, a basic type of moral equality, and commitments to democracy, and try and look at what these would demand within the firm. And what I argue, so I think democracy is something we should think about and care about, but it's not something that we can just deontologically say, democracy, efficiency be damned, right? You have, because of the viability horizons, you have to care about efficiency. But we still might think that democratic decision-making structures are better than non-democratic decision-making structures. We might tolerate some inequality, but we probably prefer institutions that tend to have, that tend not to grossly offend our egalitarian intuitions in various ways. And so I try to say, what, given the constraints that efficiency imposes on the firm, what ought we demand and what can we demand of corporations and firms in their structures, the way they're legally constrained and the way decisions are made?
Yeah, and that's helpful. I mean, maybe you could bring back in the relational theory of the corporation, because as far as I understood it, what you're talking about is we can't just be attentive to these sort of general, universal, liberal values, but also the way in which they can be contextualized within the particular corporate culture, that some corporate cultures are more amenable to these norms, others are less amenable. Does that capture it?
Yeah, basically. I mean, the idea is, if you buy my account of norm-governed productivity, and you think that the efficiency of the firm and the efficiency of the corporation, the way it's working, is deeply informed by the way norms structure the relationships between people, then these relationships are going to be really important if we're thinking normatively and legally about the firm. And so what I do is I appeal to the feminist legal tradition, particularly that articulated by Jennifer Nadelsky in her magisterial book, Laws of Relations, who argues that fundamentally when we're talking about the law, what we're talking about is an institution that structures relationships. And normatively, what we should be thinking about when we think about the law are the types of the patterns of relationships that it creates and whether these promote the values that we want to promote. And in some ways, what I want to argue in the book is whether you buy that as a general theory of law, because the corporation in particular is a type of institution that really relies on the structure of relationships, it is a particularly interesting, useful, and appropriate theory of law for corporate law. And so I kind of paint in broad strokes, and I'm not a legal scholar, so I don't get too deep in the weeds in it, but I try to paint in broad strokes and gesture towards what a relational theory of corporate law would look like. If, you know, taking the idea that corporate law ought to concern itself with the patterns of relationships it creates.
Yeah, maybe you could use an example to illustrate. I mean, I'll offer you an example. You could take it or not, or use a different example. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, this issue about religion and corporate entities and their claim to be like religious associations, you know, so is that something that corporate law ought to take into account? That is the sort of the corporate culture, as I put it before, and the way in which it's religious or not. I mean, is that an example? Or maybe you can take another example if it's more helpful.
Yeah, well, so here I'd want to distinguish between the law as it treats the corporation as a person and the law as it structures relationships within the corporation. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, what you're talking about is really, does a corporation have First Amendment rights, for instance, in some ways? I took that to be part of the tenor of your question.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's important. We'll talk about that in a second. But a lot of corporate law isn't really about that as much as it's about fiduciary obligation, it's about processes of mergers and acquisition, you know, it's about all of these sorts of things about the nitty gritty of corporations and how they're operating or running. And so I do talk about that question, and again, I want to bracket that but get to it, but also questions of, you know, what is the extent of fiduciary obligation? Is that a doctrine worth preserving, or is it a doctrine that we need to alter? And what I think a relational approach leads towards is saying something along the lines of, well, does the I keep saying fiduciary obligation. I mean, I meant to be talking about limited liability. Sorry, that's my brain fart. Let me tie them together since I messed up. When executives are exercising their fiduciary obligations towards shareholders, and we recognize that shareholders have limited liability with regards to the various debts and costs that the corporation takes on, should we alter these things in light of the types of relationships that they tend to create or they tend to pattern? And so Nadelsky actually talks about that very, very briefly. She's not primarily concerned with corporate law in her book. But she sort of says, look, the idea that the idea that managers have a fiduciary obligation to pursue profit tends to create really bad relations, tends to pattern relationships in really bad ways within the firm, and therefore we ought to, you know, we ought to reconsider this legal doctrine. And then other people say, other feminist approaches to corporate law say something similar about limited liability. They'll say, you know, the fact that people can just invest their money and just not care how, what happened, you know, what the corporation does in their name creates all these perverse incentives. And so we ought to abolish or limit, you know, or in some ways breach limited liability. And, you know, I think those sorts of questions are right, but I think it's a good deal more complicated. So there's a degree, just to take those two examples, there's a degree to which the fiduciary obligations to pursue profit is often vastly overstated in popular culture and the way we talk about it. So in fact, there's actually very little legal responsibility for managers or executives to pursue profit. There's a large, large degree of leeway that executives have when making decisions. Courts, this is called the business judgment rule, and courts, except for clear-cut cases of self-dealing, basically just defer to executives more often than not. The idea being, like, they know best, right? Why should we think that we know what would better serve these fiduciary obligations than they do? So you know, in some ways, Nedelsky just overstates what fiduciary obligation actually demands and what the patterns of relationships actually are. And then with limited liability, I think it's also a bit more difficult, but I do take that there are more instances when we ought to pierce the corporate veil, and when some people ought not have limited liability with regards to, say, corporate torts. And in these instances, we can do, but you know, and I have a complicated story about liability insurance and all that. So all is to say that it gets a good deal more complicated once you take the figure. Yeah. But the key point is recognizing that the relationships within the corporation are a normative priority, maybe, is a way of thinking about it. And looking at corporate law in that way can maybe produce different ways of thinking about what a corporation owes various parties that contract with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I take it it's sort of general point that, you know, we should be more attentive to the contextual elements and goals imminent to the corporation rather than trying to, through corporate law, sort of impose external standards on it. So that,
yeah, that's way more eloquent.
There should be, yeah. I mean, that's fine. There should be, I guess, maybe more accurate. There should be a presumption in favor of the sort of goals and relationships internal to the corporation rather than the sort of external.
Yeah, but that's good. Just to be clear, though, part of the idea of taking the relational view of corporate law would be to say, look, the fact that the corporation exists to, you know, make a profit or something like that doesn't excuse it from caring about the relationships and the types of, you know, if it creates relationships that are extremely subordinating or extremely disabling or extremely offensive to basic liberal commitments of equality, then the fact that you're pursuing profit in their name doesn't actually get you off the hook because those relationships really matter.
So yeah, I mean, this is where you're, yeah, I mean, I think you cite Jacob Levy at the beginning of the book. I mean, it sounds like, you know, this is right up the alley, Jacob's work, which is this sort of rationalist versus pluralist approach to liberalism.
Exactly.
And it sounds to me you're more on the sort of, you know, just to be clear, rationalist is the sort of top-down model of liberalism, you know, and inspired all the way back, I guess, to Hobbes, whereas the more pluralist is the more, I suppose, Montesquieuian approach to sort of bottom-up approach. And so yours is sounds to me like your relational theory skews more on the side of the pluralist approach, but with the proviso that some sort of rationalist approach should be there, and in the case that the corporation slides off the rails, I suppose.
So that's something like, I mean, I guess it depends who you're comparing me to. So compared to a sort of strict Rawlsian, I'm much more of a pluralist. Compared to Jacob, I'm a rationalist. So I think you're right that the relational view of the corporation is a pluralist idea. The idea of justice failures that I introduced in the last chapter is a much more rationalist idea.
So maybe we could turn to that.
A lot of what I'm trying to do is kind of skate between those two poles, right? So taking in part the empirical observation that comes from the pluralist tradition very seriously, while also thinking that there's something like broader social values that ought to animate these things in the picture at the same time.
Good. Yeah. So the last chapter on business ethics, you talk about justice failures and market failures. And it's an interesting account of business ethics. I mean, you advocate for something like a negative duty on the part of corporations, that is, sort of not contribute, that businesses ought not contribute to market failures. They ought not to contribute to justice failures. Why do you take up that sort of negative approach? Why not say, you know, especially in the case of justice failures, you know, the corporation has a positive duty to promote justice?
Yeah. So it's maybe worth taking a step back and thinking about just, I imagine a lot of political theorists aren't terribly familiar with the literature in business ethics. And so a lot of business, so I teach in a business school, I teach business ethics. A lot of business ethics is frankly very confused. But for a while you had these kind of three broad approaches. So one, and this is still very prevalent, even if people don't state it exactly like this, is a kind of Christian virtue ethics approach. You know, so it's about being the right type of leader, the right type, you know, pursuing the right types of goals and these sorts of things. And this leads to a lot of talk about social responsibility and following your conscience and, you know, sort of having a type of moral courage to live up to your convictions in various ways. And again, so that's there and is especially prevalent less in the academic literature, but more in just public. You know, if you pick up a lot of Harvard Business Review stuff, there's a lot of stuff about, you know, they wanted me to do this, but I lived up to, I thought about what my conscience demanded and I lived up to it. And there's a lot of that sort of intuitionist type of stuff deep within it. So that's one kind of broad approach. The two more straightforward camps in the academic literature are the profit maximization school, or the shareholder wealth maximization school, largely associated with Milton Friedman, which says, look, what is the ethics of a corporate executive? The ethics are strictly about their fiduciary obligation, right? It's just to make profit for their shareholders. That's it. It's a principal-agent relationship, and that's your ethical concerns. And a lot of people, just as a sidebar, a lot of people take that to be an abdication of ethics, but it's really not. It is really saying, no, there is a moral commitment to pursue profit and not to pursue, say, your own self-improvement or your own self-enrichment, right? You have an obligation towards your shareholders. So it's a minimal ethics, but it is an ethics. So that's the shareholder school. And then there's what's often called the stakeholder school, which is very, very popular in academic business ethics. And what they sort of did was say, oh, Milton Friedman says executives have a fiduciary obligation to pursue the interests of their stockholders. Actually, executives have a fiduciary obligations towards their stakeholders. And that's all of these different parties. And you actually have to weigh all of these things. And your fiduciary obligation is to them generally. And so that's sort of the landscape. And that's been the landscape for a while. And what I argue in the book, and this is taking up from Joseph Heath's engagement and intervention in this literature, and full disclosure, he was my other dissertation supervisor. So in part, he's quite influential on me on this approach, who says, you know, look, but both of these schools kind of miss the mark in various ways. And what we really need to do is think about what the purpose of the market is, what the purpose of the firm is, why we have these institutions, and then think about what morality demands based on that sort of functional assessment of these institutions. And so the idea is that, on Heath's account, these institutions exist for efficiency reasons. They produce efficiency. And therefore, this creates moral obligations on the part of firms and those who lead them to not take advantage of market failures and not profit off of market failure, because then you're contradicting the very basis for your institution's existence in the first place. Like, why we condone firms to just pursue profit in a competitive economy is because it produces efficiency. But if you're pursuing profit by polluting rivers or by, you know, taking advantage of information asymmetries and telling your customers all sorts of wrong stuff about your products, you're not contributing to efficiency. You're profiting in the wrong way. And so that's where that's sort of that's the background for that school and why that approach kind of exists and its big argument. And I take that as roughly right, but I say it's not just efficiency that matters. That is, markets exist within political societies. They're not quarantined from them. They're structured by and through and within them. And therefore, you can't just say, oh, the state will deal with justice and equality. The market will deal with efficiency. You have to recognize that that division of labor is also going to be faulty and is also going to fall apart, and these things will interpenetrate one another. And as a consequence, you don't just have a duty not to take advantage of market inefficiency. You have a duty not to take advantage of injustice as well. So to get to your question, though, why do I frame it in this negative way? I would say that that then could create certain positive duties, though, right? I mean, because in part, so I talk briefly about living wages, right? And that if you're operating in such a way where you're taking advantage of the the fact that there's no welfare state and the fact that there's no social safety net or the fact that there's no minimum wage laws, and you're taking advantage of that, you're taking advantage of a justice failure, and you actually potentially ought to be paying more than you might necessarily be legally obliged to in order to counteract that justice failure.
Oh, okay. So there actually might be a duty to counteract a justice failure in society. I thought the idea was you shouldn't contribute to justice failure.
Yeah, so that's definitely the first part, and the main part is to not take advantage of and profit from those things. And I think that's not an insignificant ask, just based on
corporations. Yeah, sure.
But the reason why I am, and you're right to point out my anxiety and hesitancy with regards to asking positive duties, is because I think there's this really important aspect of political justice that we need to worry about, which is by saying, oh, don't just avoid justice failures, but be an agent of social justice. What we're essentially doing, especially in the case of large corporations, is saying, you know, asking these very rich people with very powerful institutions to enact their vision of social justice in various ways. And so part of the reason why I'm hesitant to ask a lot of positive duties is because I think there's a political justice failure where corporations have too much say and too much power in our democratic processes. And I think giving ethical cover for CEOs or other people to kind of just use corporate funds to pursue what they think is right actually further exacerbates that problem and contributes to another sort of political justice failure, which I think is a very serious problem.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, this transitions to my last question, which is the sort of the broader landscape of sort of contemporary capitalism and the role of corporations and social justice. I mean, because one of the things that occurred to me when thinking about the justice failures here is we actually do expect quite a bit of corporations in advancing social justice. We just in the form of anti-discrimination laws, which I mean, I guess you could pose that in the sort of negative duty way. We also have a move towards pay equity, and indeed, you know, concerns about pay disparity, especially between the genders, but between the races too. More generally, and this is what I'm interested in your take on, is that corporations, especially tech corporations like Google, seem to be moving towards taking more of a role in advancing a kind of moral cause. Google is a perfect example of this, although there are plenty of other corporations, you know, like Tim Cook at Apple has been very outspoken on some of these issues. So what do you think about that? I mean, how does that fit in? First of all, I guess, how does that fit in with your theory? Are those businesses acting in accordance with what you would hope or expect them to do?
Yeah. So this is a big part of, a big difficulty with talking to business students about these sorts of things is part of my problem with that first approach to business ethics that I was talking about in terms of consulting your conscience and living up to your conviction, is that it doesn't take seriously how the mere fact that you have the power to impose this vision onto others might in itself be an injustice or might at least be in tension with justice. The fact that you believe certain things isn't enough to make what you're doing moral or just. It actually has to be, you know, there's you need to take seriously the whole social context in which you're acting, and not just be trying to strive for what you believe is right, but also maybe trying to empower others to be able to contribute in the right ways as well. So that's sort of, I guess, a side note to answering this. But yeah, so this is part of actually the next book project that I'm working on with Amit Ron, is this project which tries to say, what does democracy demand of corporations, right? So if we take democratic theory seriously, what does it demand, not in terms of like the structure of corporations, but what does it demand of business ethics? What sorts of ethical obligations do executives and managers have in light of their impact on democratic decision making? And so we're still, you know, still working through these things, but the idea would be that it's complicated, I guess. I mean, you know, part, because I go back and forth on this, to be perfectly honest. So if you take, you know, so Apple, or you take, you know, take the Gates Foundation, right? So philanthropic organizations are a whole other beast in some ways. But you take these sorts of things where it's people using their wealth, using their power to pursue really good things often, right? Well, there's two ways to think about it, and I think they're both kind of accurate. One is they're solving problems, and that should be taken seriously. And sometimes they're solving problems that they are uniquely competent to solve or uniquely positioned to solve. You know, so Zuckerberg has a certain type of power that he uniquely has to control to monitor the discourse of you know, American politics in various ways, right? It seems like there should be some obligation for him to act in the right way with regards to it. On the other hand, asking people to do that is also in many ways deeply undemocratic, right? Because what you're doing is saying, like, you, rich CEO, you powerful guy, you solve the problem. Instead of contribute to the way we can all collectively solve the problem. And, you know, my democratic instincts tend to say the fact that what they're doing is deeply anti-democratic might be a problem. That looms large, but I also have to recognize that our democratic systems are also deeply, deeply, deeply flawed. If I can make a controversial statement, sometimes our democratic systems don't produce the right outcomes. In which case, you know, you need to compare like to like, and it's not like the choices between, you know, Apple or Zuckerberg or whoever making certain decisions or the people making decisions. It's actually it's these people making these decisions or this very bad system which has put in power kind of crappy people to make those decisions. And so it's not obvious what to do in those instances. So, I have less of a clear answer, but I think those questions are actually the questions that are really important.
Well, that's great. I mean, I look forward to talking more about that, because going to become more and more of an issue as we move along. I mean, I too go back and forth on these sorts of issues. I mean, in part, politicization of American business is, I think, lamentable, given how it contributes to polarization in American politics and the sort of, yeah, the widening gulf between American life. But on the other hand, you might think, like, you know, I mean, you have a powerful organization. If it can do some good in society, this is in part what we might expect out of, if you return to the function of a corporation, you might expect that the function of a corporation is not just to produce wealth, but it also might be to produce some, you know, broader social good. That's a difficult question.
The very Levian pluralist would be to say, right, part of what corporations can do is push back against these things, right? No, I mean, in some ways, what I'd want to say, and again, this is the basis of the next project, is to say there's no non-political place for corporations or businesses to be put in. Right. So like trying to,
we're always politicized.
And so whether you think that they should stay out of it or whether you think they should have free reign to go in, the idea that you can just separate economics from politics, separate markets from the state in this very clear cut, simple way is not a good look, and it's not going to work. And instead, what you need is actually an ethics of political engagement. You sort of see this now with people who are very critical of corporate political activity, but they're kind of okay with it when it's against Trump or when it's against racism. Right. You know, like a lot of time, and not that that's a diss on any of that stuff, but it is interesting to note how many people are against corporate political activity until it aligns with their political views, and then it's cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would think that the basis of an ethics of corporate engagement would be to actually have a duty to some kind of consensus view of justice rather than being partisan, because it's the partisan, I think, politicization that's the problem.
Yeah.
But what
the idea of justice failure is supposed to do, right? Is focus on those consensus issues than on more controversial ones.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, come back and let's talk when the next project's done. We'll three of us.
Yeah.
We'll tackle this.
That's a good incentive.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Well, Abe, thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks. This was a blast.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.